I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Chase Joint has just published a provocative, fascinating book, Vantage Points on Media as Trans Memoir. As you'll hear, a box of family mementos arrives, and a heretofore unknown connection to Marshall McLuhan comes up. Joint finds out of all he can about distant relations, and using McLuhan's seminal Understanding Media as an inciting framework, writes this book that looks at the legacy of childhood sexual abuse, masculinity, family, creativity, film, art, transition, gender, and more. It's a rich book of vignettes, an often exciting tapestry of montage-like essays and illustrations. Chase joins me now, and I'll ask him about what it was like looking back at abuse at the hands of an uncle and neglect from his father, among other traumas, and finding a way through media to understand what happened or glean some explanations of the experiences. And as you'll hear, the experience of the book, not just reading but thinking about it and looking at it, will likely glean for the reader some wisdom or even connection or reflection. Chase Joint is a director and writer whose films have won a number of awards internationally. His latest documentary feature, Framing Agnes, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, where it won the Next Innovator Award and the Next Audience Award. He is the co-author of the Lambda Literary Award finalist, You Only Live Twice, and Boys Don't Cry. This new book is from Arsenal Pulp Press. We spoke 1 week ago with Chase joining me from Los Angeles, California. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Chase Joint. Chase, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
So happy to be here.
This is often a tough book to read because you write about the abuse you suffered as a child because of your uncle, X, as he's addressed in the book. Writing this book as you have, did you write from a place of wanting to understand what happened, or was this a place where you had already healed and were now willing to impart all of this to the reader?
Oh, that's a really interesting approach to that question. You know, I think that for me, making work, whether it's writing books or making movies, is always a process of discovery. It's always trying to ask questions that I don't have the answers to. And I think one of the particularities of childhood sexual abuse and violence is that it's never totally healed or resolved, but it's also, unfortunately, so common and shared that I wanted to create a project that felt like a conversation where it didn't put me or my family or my circumstances in isolation, but really connected us to many other folks who are asking questions about intergenerational violence and family and masculinity.
And when you share it with the audience, as you do in this book, you know, it makes life more readable for us.
Yes.
Was that something that you felt you needed to do, or say you felt it was urgent? Because, I mean, you know, talking about what one suffers, abuse especially, is not something that a lot of people do right away even. In your case, was it something that you wanted to, say, speak to a specific reader even about?
You know, it's one of those things that has hovered in the background of my career for more than a decade, these questions of masculinity and violence and inheritance. And I could never figure out the right form. I had played a little bit in moving image and experimented a little bit with other kinds of artistic creation, but it wasn't until encountering Marshall McLuhan or traces of Marshall McLuhan in my family archive that I recognized a form, a structure that could really hold the weight of these kinds of stories.
And it is the way that the book is told, or how it's laid out, I should say, the design, the typography, everything seems deliberate and cinematic in a way.
Yes.
The book that we're holding in our hands, is this how you saw it in your mind? I mean, even its size is specific, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for this very geeky opportunity to wax on about the formal inspirations of the book. So, you know, the book that you're holding is a direct structural citation of Marshall McLuhan's The Medium is the Massage, which is arguably one of his most famous works. And so it fits in the palm of your hand. It's a sort of radical thinking between text and image. And there are many inspirations that I think if you were to put the two books beside each other, you would see the conversation that I'm trying to have there. And of course, that's also me in conversation with Jasmine Welsh, who's the Arsenal Pulp Press book designer. And we spent many months together trying to reckon with the relationship between text and image, because I think that design in some ways is as important as the rest, because it is an additional component of the storytelling.
And the only color really is the green that we see on the cover. How did you pick that? Did McLuhan do that as well, or?
You know, his text is very iconographic. It's a bold red with a kind of mid-century taupe and lots of blacks and whites. Huh. So in some ways we're riffing on that. And then the green really emerged from a lot of different design experiments with Jasmine in service of creating a new look for Vantage Points that was, you know, in conversation with things from the past, but also had its own distinct feel.
So as you can tell, I don't know much about Marshall McLuhan. And so for the reader, before we start Vantage Points, what do we need to know about him, and specifically that one book that you just mentioned? I guess, is it a surprise that people haven't read him in 2024 as they should have?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we all get our information from all kinds of different sources, and I don't think that you need to know anything about McLuhan in order to pick up Vantage Points. And I think that if you're someone who knows a lot about McLuhan, you might understand some of the moves it's trying to make differently. But that's not really a hierarchy. I don't think one is better than the other. But for folks who might not know anything about him, he's often understood as the sort of father of Canadian media theory. He is a very hotly contested subject. People love him. People hate him. People think he's a genius. People think he's full of crap. Like, it really runs the gamut. But one of the most important things that he offers us is this phrase, the medium is the message, which I think at its most simplest of articulations is a way to think about how we communicate, not just what we communicate. And so it's a real invitation to consider media's impacts on human relations.
And a lot of the communication, because you think about this quite seriously and thoughtfully as you write Vantage Points and think about your experiences, is you're able to understand what happened to you through various modes of how one communicates the popular culture. I'm trying to think of, like you mentioned the car, for example,
yeah.
and incidences in your life involving a car or music. That is a way for you to understand a lot of what's happened. And I guess a lot of this happens, in retrospect, doesn't it?
Right. Absolutely. You know, I think one of the things that McLuhan usefully instructs is he says, you know, we can understand changes in human behavior through recognizing changes in media cultures. So an easy way to understand that is he's like, you can actually see how speeches become contained into books and then books become contained into movies, right? We're in a culture where books are being adapted into movies all the time. And the key important part for him is he's like, and through this transformation, you can look back at those forms and see how they work. And so I'm taking that seriously, and I'm trying to think, how can we see how life works through sustained attention to these different media cultures? And more importantly, I'm sort of doubling down on that and trying to think about that as it relates to masculinity. So What happens when I take a look back at my father, at my grandfather, at the masculinities that surrounded me in my childhood and my becoming, and what can I learn about being, in particular, a trans man myself?
Yeah, and the other thing that you look at, too, is the racism that you saw around you or heard around you, especially growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And how that's even facilitated and because of other elements in society. When you talk about the abuse from your uncle, as well as your father's own neglect and behavior, you think about that seriously as you transition. One wonders if your idea of masculinity is affected by them, because they're inevitably for you examples of masculinity. You quote Kierkegaard in one part of the book where Kierkegaard talks about anxiety about sin produces sin. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible to become a man, say, and resist all the patterns through the people around you as a child? I mean, it is. But right. How do you deal with that as you're, you know, because these are obviously things that you're thinking about a lot, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're bringing up, you know, one of the central questions of the book is, you know, how do we interrupt these intergenerational transmissions? How do we live in a culture that, you know, afforded men and masculinities the kind of permission that it does not afford other folks? And then what does my experience as a trans person, so someone who was not born and reared as a boy, what does that kind of perspective offer me as now a, you know, fully formed adult human? And one of the things that I think a lot about is accountability and complicity and how those things are actually related. And I think that one of the things that I hope is, you know, even as I write about my dad very briefly in the book, it's by no means a takedown of any one person or any one thing, but it's rather thinking about the context of our becoming and the context of our upbringing. My dad, my uncle, my grandfather, all these masculinities are also shaped by their context and by their brutalizing context, which required them to shave off parts of themselves, to become less vulnerable. And so I hope that my project is an invitation to think again about what might be possible, because I do believe that we have the chance to change these patterns, and I do believe it's through, you know, taking seriously the ability that we all have to try again.
Now, I notice that you're just about a year older than I am. So this was fascinating to read, because we're obviously we grew up in the same sort of popular culture and whatever technology that there was, and how that's changed over our lifetimes, our lives. When you think about what it's like growing up, because it's tough for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And you reconcile where you are today, as you know, and not just as a man but as a professional, even as an artist. Do you wonder, because you do contrast that with your parents' generation, your grandparents' generation, and especially throughout the book, McLuhan's generation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you because we like to think that we as a species have evolved somehow.
Yeah.
Do you, in your own family even, because in your own lineage, say, as you think about these things quite seriously in vantage points, are you able to look objectively at what you've become and where it's come from even, and try to figure or calculate just how evolved one might have become?
It's a really interesting question that I'm sure I don't have.
I'm putting it very badly, but I've learned a great deal about you having read this book, I just found it so fascinating as you investigate, say, McLuhan's life and not just his life, but other family members that mm-hmm. you're related to, because it is hard to look back at you know, one generation, even two generations back. You know, I think for people who are born today and who'll be, you know, our age, you know, 43 years hence, it'll be a lot easier for them to do that probably because of technology.
I mean, I think that there's something very paper-based about the return to McLuhan and return to my grandfather's generation.
Yeah.
Sorry, I realized I interrupted you.
To
sort of riff with you, I think, you know, definitely there's an opportunity to think about evolution and change. And boy, I hope that that's true, even while I understand that the process is ongoing and will never be finished. But the other thing that I'm learning through this project, too, is that time, of course, is not linear, and we circle and we loop back and we take pivots. And so I hope in some ways the form of the book reflects that as well. It's resisting a kind of linear conclusion. It's resisting an A plus B equals C kind of equation about how one might understand their life.
Yeah, I guess the idea of patterns, that comes through as I'm reading the book, and you know, you consider your own life, say, as you're reading, you know, anything you consume. These things, you know, they repeat, don't they, not in specific ways or the same ways, but in odd ways that make you think, you know, not to get spiritual here or anything like that, but you know, there is something here other than just our own decisions or our own doing, say.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
That we are fated somehow by who we're related to, or you know, I mean, that certainly forms a part of our identity in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's very McLuhan of you to recognize that, too, because I think one of the things that we can learn from him, or that we can learn from the folks who have studied him, is that he was, in some ways, hell-bent on pattern recognition, right? He was trying to look out across a variety of different technological and media scapes to identify patterns, and I think it's true in Vantage Points as well, as I'm trying to look across a different set of data, whether it be my family history or media theory or any of these other texts, to find patterns and connections.
So you mentioned a moment ago that a lot of people, you know, revere him and hold him in great regard. There's some people that don't. And so when you are writing Vantage Points, how do you consider, say, some of the misogyny in his writing or even racism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I have a very easy answer, which is that we are lucky to live in a world where there's a cohort of feminist scholars who are thinking critically about McLuhan's work and legacy. There's a book in particular called Re-Understanding Media that really served as a guidebook for me in terms of how to navigate this terrain. And, you know, one of the things that they say up front in that book is we are not here to absolve him of his sins. You know, yeah. We are not here to make excuses for his racism and for his misogyny. But what we do understand is that he recognized something that was incredibly important, which is that technology is a structuring form of power. And if we take that seriously, what's possible? And I really understood through my reading of their work that that was a kind of permission, that I can take parts of his work that made sense as vehicles for my own understanding, and then to recognize the limitations and to state them, to not absolve him, as I'm not really absolving anyone in the book, myself included, but rather to move from that place of confidence.
Yeah, that's an important thing to consider when we revere certain pieces of work, that we take what we need out of them, I guess. And we move on.
And there's something about not erasing the problem,
right? Yeah, exactly. That's right. You know, I found it just fascinating for people listening to us. You didn't know growing up of this connection to McLuhan, did you?
No, I didn't.
How long ago was it that you actually did find out about it?
You know, it's interesting because the box arrived to my family home in 2017 after the death of my grandfather, and it was upon searching through the materials that I really recognized the McLuhan connection. But as soon as that happened, my mom did mention to me that it has existed in the kind of ether of their family history for as long as they were alive, and a few clicks on the internet revealed that, you know, some folks claimed McLuhan as an uncle and as all these other things. And, you know, a quick look at family genealogy or ancestry.com reveals that McLuhan is by no means an uncle. You know, it is not that close of a relation, if it's a relation at all. But it was interesting to me that I was not the first in the family to try to grab hold of or make sense of the appearance of this name and, of course, this person in history in our legacy.
Yeah, this box itself, as you mentioned a moment ago, you know, it's a collection of paper essentially that could have easily disappeared at one point and not set you forth on this investigation. as you have. I guess it also speaks to a different sort of generation as to what was kept, even, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so the box contained, you're absolutely right to summarize it as paper. It contained, you know, what we would consider binders. So they're not binders. They're kind of adhesive pages that contain newspaper clippings, photos, letters. There's a number of published books. There's a number of metal boxes that contain small packages and envelopes of photographs. There's travel journals that were written by Mabel Beatrice McLuhan, who's the foundational McLuhan connection in the story. Oh. And it's interesting because it really is just a box. It is one singular, large, heavy box, and it's from within that box that the project was really born.
The other funny thing I noticed as I was reading Vantage was that people write very differently today, their penmanship, I should say, today than it is then as it is now, isn't it?
Indeed, absolutely. Yeah, there's some pretty incredible scripts, and, you know, the box also gave us access to telegrams and telegraphs and letters from Parliament and government, and the style of speaking and the sort of performance of importance was really notable to me.
Where I work, because I'm 42, where I work, you know, there are people younger than I am. I don't know what you call that generation, Xennials or whatever. None of them know how to cursive write anymore. It's all printed.
Right. I don't even think they teach it anymore.
No. See, that's the thing. I think we're of the last generation where that happened, I think.
Agreed. We've got to keep it alive.
Indeed. So have you found at all writing Vantage Points healing?
Yes, absolutely. And not to be trite, but just to say that I think a sustained engagement with these ideas and questions did really serve my, you know, ongoing desire to forgive and heal and let go and metabolize, but also perhaps more importantly, allowed me to have a continued conversation with my mom about her history and our relation to each other, and, you know, to encounter her finally having the book in her hands and to recognize what became of our many conversations was a really meaningful experience.
So you do feel, because healing and feeling complete are two different things, you do feel more complete in terms of one's identity even?
If I feel more complete, but I definitely feel like perhaps we can use a metaphor like composting or something like that. Mm. I do feel like I have offered a number of ingredients to the pile and they've been turned over into a kind of soil, and I don't think that that completes the process, but perhaps it indicates the transformation of some parts of the process in service of what will come next.
I guess I really want to know. I mean, it is better is a loaded word, healthier probably is that what you feel perhaps?
I think that I understand your question absolutely, and I think that for me, one of the things that the book allowed was to put my personal experience in conversation with others, and there's great comfort in that kind of companionship. And so I don't know if it's healthier or better, and I totally understand the overweightedness of those words, but I do feel differently about my experiences on account of having written it.
Could you tell us about The People's Best from 1927? I guess, was this a book? This is obviously a list. Was it found in a book?
Yes, exactly. So there was a book called The People's Best, which was published in the 1930s, by O.J. Stevenson, who is, you know, a member of my extended family, who was an intellectual. And it contains 31 portraits of people eminent in the arts about whom the broader Canadian public should learn more about. And one of the things that's interesting about the book, first of all, is that it's in the box of my grandfather's belongings. And second of all, O.J. admits that Mabel, his wife, was the author of many of the entries, but did not want to be attributed as author. And I think it's such an interesting portrait of the time and the thinking about who gets remembered, right? And how without that piece of information, she is entirely invisibilized from the process. And so I took it as an opportunity to signal boost 31 creatives in our contemporary landscape about whom the public should know more about.
Yeah, it's a great list, and I found it fascinating because there are a number of people that we all know, and there's some people that we don't know. And I found myself with a book next to me, Googling some of these names, and they're marvelous artists in their own right, and it's really great that you've taken the time to say to laud them in the book, because as you say, they do influence your creative life and thinking, don't they?
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate your attention to it. It's actually a real boost to me to know that you were reading and Googling in that way.
Yeah. Someone in the book, and it's in the form of a letter, is it a letter? I think it's just a... They talk about a power outside that holds them.
Oh, yes, that's Mabel McClure.
Yeah, Mabel, yeah. As I said a moment ago, I'm not a terribly spiritual person, but as I think about vantage points and I think about one's own life and around them, I can't help but think that there is something beyond us that's guiding us through. And I don't know what that is. I mean... after having read Vantage Points, I might think that, you know, it's one's family history that perhaps we're thinking about as we're going about our lives day to day. Do you think that, I mean, in your own life, I mean, do you think that there is a power outside yourself that holds you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think as an artist and creative person, I've never been more convinced that there are powers and forces that move ideas and sensations through our bodies and back out into the world. I think some of the most inspiring people that I know don't even identify as artists. They identify as portals where things come through them. I'm thinking in particular about Beverly Glenn Copeland, who exists on that list of people's best in my book and who's an extraordinary artist and speaks about his legacy and career in that way. And, you know, it's notable to me that someone like Mabel McLuhan identifies that spiritual source in her writing, because she is also such a formative part of Vantage Points as a work and could have so easily been avoided if we were doing a more traditional reading of that archival collection. But it's only through a pivot and then a reattention to her that we get access to those ideas.
And thinking about because I finished Vantage Points a while ago now, and I'm holding it in my hand, you know, flipping through it as we're talking. There's so much of your life that you've put in here, and not just your own experience, but, you know, the family history, obviously, and the stuff in this box. It's just wonderful to see how you've created something so thoughtful I can't help but think you'll get a lot of people coming up to you. Readers will tell you they see themselves through in the pages of this book. And I guess I can't think of a better way or a reason why to write a book like this than that.
Thank you. Yes, I really, it is my greatest hope that is the reaction, that there is a way in which folks can see and feel themselves or understand new ways of interpreting what's going on for them, and I'm grateful for your interpretation.
And now the cinema and that art form itself, you're a filmmaker, that really has, as I was reading the book, that really has changed how we view things. I mean, how we read text even, and I guess, you know, that goes back to McLuhan. In a way, McLuhan probably said that.
totally.
are you able to quantify just how we've changed over the last 100 years, say, because of movies?
Oh my goodness. I don't think I could necessarily quantify, but I can say that I feel like that transformation is what allowed me to approach Vantage Points in this way, which is to say it's from a movie-making background and experience that I approach the ways in which words and image appear on these pages. So it's really trying to take seriously montage, right? So cinema offered us this extraordinary opportunity to put two things alongside each other that produce a third meaning, right? And that is true to vantage points as well, is what happens if you are to read these things back to back. Things that you wouldn't necessarily expect are related all of a sudden become something that produces a new conclusion or a new question or a new opportunity to be considered.
Yeah, that's the thing that I found fascinating as I was reading the book is, and this is what you're trying to impart on the reader, I think, is how we read text has changed because it's been influenced at least by film and cinema. That
exactly right.
We don't recognize that sometimes. We forget that, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the things that cinema studies also offers us is an understanding about genre, right, which at its perhaps easiest summary is about a set of characteristics or traits. Like, we understand what a horror film is because it shares a set of traits to other horror films. And we can think about that as it relates to life writing, you know, what happens when memoir or writing about one's life has a set of traits that you already understand. And so Vantage Points is trying to disrupt or at least draw attention to, you know, the structure of writing about one's life and the structure of memoir itself.
Well, we can get quite nostalgic about music, for example. What is it like for you with certain songs? Because you do write about music that you heard growing up. You know, when we hear certain songs for a lot of us, you know, that we heard, say, years ago or grew up with, that can be quite pleasant and nostalgic. But there is some music that isn't for you, right?
Right, absolutely. So I think that's true.
What is it like when you, say, walk into a shop and it's playing or you hear it on television and the sort? Do you find yourself that you have to turn it off? Or your relationship with a particular song perhaps has changed over time, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's true for all of us. I mean, it's one of the most transformative and powerful parts of music is I think the way it lives in our souls or lives on our skin. And there's no music in the world that I have to turn off these days, but they definitely are forever stitched to memories, and I find that to be incredibly energizing. It's really true to McLuhan's early hypotheses and proclamations about the power that media has on our sense of reality, and I think music is the one of the easiest to understand articulations of that. And you know, it was a way for me to think also about how music impacted other folks in my family. And I think so much about how my mom, you know, won a radio contest in the 60s and was front row at the Beatles concert in Toronto's Maple Leaf Gardens. I mean, it's just wild to consider my mom as a little person, you know, being sweated on by the Beatles in their prime and the kind of, you know, imprint that would have on her. And then how can I make a connection between that and, you know, being gifted a mixtape by an early crush in my becoming and, you know, thinking across those connections and histories.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today, Chase. I could talk all afternoon with you. Congratulations. It's a very fine piece of work and continued good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our chat.
The book is called Vantage Points on Media as Trans Memoir. It is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Its author, Chase Joint, join me on the line from Los Angeles and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.